Now, this here is a spoof interior, too. This is a museum created after the French Revolution where they got into it originals and also mock-ups of medieval structures. There is, I think it's closed now, but there was a Musée des Monuments Français, which probably ranks as one of the most boring museums one could ever go round. It's in the Trocadero, where this reassembly, if you like, of medievalism also could be found. Now, there's a very theatrical element in all of these things, and indeed they are linked to Walter Scott, to the plays that became very popular. There was a sort of desire to have this sort of popular history in visual and theatrical means. And of course, Joan of Arc was going to be very popular in this kind of tradition. And here she is. This is Delaroche, a sketch for the bigger painting that he did. And there she is in her cell being interviewed by Cardinal Beaufort, the Bishop of Winchester. Quite a good picture. We know it's a cardinal because in the final version he's all in red. Great, except Cardinal Beaufort was not involved at all in the questioning of Joan of Arc. It was done entirely by French clergy. He wasn't even in Rouen for most of the trial. He may have been present at the burning of Joan, but he's certainly not there at all. So this is a complete fabrication. But many people do, from things like this, believe that that is true, because, as I say, seeing is believing. Now, the Victorian schoolroom, of course, perpetuated this, and we've got here a picture of the Battle of Agincourt by Gilbert, loads of these sort of historical paintings. Reading Borough Council has a whole set of these paintings, mid-19th century, on the history of Reading, and they're just really quite amazing. You know, Becket consecrates Reading Abbey, all that sort of thing. So there's a Victorian view, though, of course, of all of this. This is a period of Romanticism, and clearly that is a great influence. And it's quite intriguing that Balzac commented that French history had been, he even invented an adjective, Walter Scotty. He created that adjective. At this time as well, there was a great interchange between France and England, and indeed it's fascinating that Delaroche painted largely English history scenes, including, of course, the famous one of Lady Jane Grey. History and literature, then, obviously is a very important link here. And I think we also see in this a British-centred approach, perhaps a kind of Ireland story, an emphasis on great moments and great people, a particularly monarch-based thing. It does, I think, worry me less when I read in the paper that children nowadays don't know their lists of kings and queens. I'm sure other people in the audience, you know, prided ourselves on knowing this and reciting them without actually knowing what it all meant. And I don't know whether we should get too involved in this mechanistic thing. I'm sure that history syllabuses are more to do with understanding of what the past means and how we can study it, and of trends rather than of key individuals. The question of what knowledge is, I think, is a very intriguing one in history. Should we worry if the young are unable to recognise Churchill? That's an issue in today's Metro and Daily Telegraph. Would they recognise Margaret Thatcher? Would I recognise politicians of the early 20th century if I saw a photograph of them? Will people in 2050 recognise even Michael Jackson? You know, things move on, and I don't think we should necessarily see this as a lack of understanding of history if you can't recognise a particular person. Will people today, in fact, my husband and I were talking about this on the train coming up. He said, he was commenting as he was a returning officer in Reading last week, he said, was it wise for Gordon Brown to wheel out Tony Blair? Because did people know who Tony Blair was? And, you know, things move on. Our son did an MA in politics at Essex, where he had to write an essay on why the Tories lost the election in 2001. And my husband said, well, it was Europe, wasn't it? And Tom said, that's not what the textbooks say. So living in that period, you might have a different view of what was going on from what the pundits and the political scientists say later. I think the way popular history is put into the public domain is actually crucial here, because, of course, a lot of it is seeing is believing. We've seen the birth of, and I know this is a term of art now, the TV historian. I was rung up yesterday to ask whether I'd comment on the film Robin Hood and the reference to an invasion by the French of Hampton Bay. The classic response to this is to name another colleague and give the other phone extension and pass it on. There are the computer games. My son has fought the Battle of Agincourt on several occasions, and he's patriotic enough, of course, to let the English win, but I think for Waterloo he has had other results. There is also the popular historian. Now, I need to be careful here because it'll sound like sour grapes that, you know, I'm dependent on a public sector salary, I could be making more money out of my history, all that sort of stuff. But I'm talking here about the books at the front at Waterstones. The consumption of historical works is highly controlled and directed for commercial reasons, the same as Jamie Oliver's cookbooks. How do you make a book sell? Well, don't put maybe and perhaps. Publishers don't like that in. They don't really like sources, so they always put the footnotes at the back. What makes a book sell? Extreme views, reinforcing widely held views, absolutes, and standard themes and colourful personalities. Narration. I'm always being told by publishers, just tell the story. And when I did the Osprey book on the Hundred Years' War, I wrote a section on women in the period and the effects of war on women. And I was told, oh, our readers don't like things on women. So the compromise was to write about Christine de Pizan, who had wrote a handbook, a sort of military treatise. That was just about okay, because it showed how men were supposed to fight. So there's all sorts of agendas with publishers that are really quite problematic, I think. And, of course, popular historians, I have put in the margin here perhaps a new term about the potboiler historian, can move away from sources and come to an interpretation that the author wishes, even though they put very good research into their book, although they do tend to rely on printed sources and also what other historians have done. I think sometimes there's a confusion between history and the historical novel. One of my colleagues has recently written a biography on Anne Boleyn. Very interesting. This is George Bernard, and I do recommend reading it. And he says at one point, if I were a historical novelist, I'd tell you how Anne felt about this. But I've nothing to go on. I can't do that. But of course, popular historians try to do that because they think that's what the public want to read. How then does the professional medieval historian fit into this situation? Well, sometimes we're encouraged to be the crossover historian. The accessibility is an issue here. As Richard Overy wrote, history has to come down from the ivory tower and enter the marketplace if it is to survive. But of course, historians have a duty to be objective, to go to the best and earliest sources, even if these are unpublished, and to treat them in the best critical fashion, to see linkages, to set in context. And we can't come to the absolutes that publishers and TV directors think that the public want. Why then don't we have more influence? Well, because the results of our work are often very thinly distributed. Historians may be partly to blame for this. We all want to go for the best presses, and therefore we publish 250 copies of our book. We need to satisfy the research assessment exercise, where the criteria are rigour, significance, and originality. Most commercial publishers wouldn't care anything about those things. And we also have scepticism about web-based activity. Publishers are reluctant to allow any material they've published into the public domain. I'm having that battle currently over what we have at Southampton called e-prints. You can have a look at the website and see. You can see my articles there, but you can't see my articles because the publishers won't allow full copy to go on the website. And I think the future of publishing is crucial here. I think we've got to open up, professional historians have got to open up on the use of the web. In terms of dissemination to the widest possible group, surely that's got to happen. And it has great implications for globalisation of history as well. The HA is a vital tool for this, not just the talks, but the potential it has as a gateway for professional historians. Now, there's got to be a middle way. That's probably old talk now, the third way, I think it was, isn't it? And I want to say a little bit about an effort to do this. Now, this sounds as though I'm blowing my own trumpet. It isn't, quite like that, because I think there are shortcomings in the database and the work that I've got here, but I want to show you something of what might be possible, really. And this is the database that I've been creating. That's www.medievalsoldier.org, funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. Now, its aim is, you can get this all from its website, to look at soldiers over the whole period, to see length of careers, to see links between them and all that kind of thing. It's just done through Microsoft Access, so it's a bit clunky. That's a problem there. And that's a problem, isn't it? Because there's so many all singing, all dancing sites like Wikipedia that ones produced by universities can seem terrible. And that's been the liberation of the HA, has been to have such a better website. It's based on material in the National Archives, British Library, and also in French repositories, a vast number of sources that we've put in here. It could have only been possible through a team, and we wrote an article about this in The Historian in autumn 2007, and you can sort of tell from that whether I've aged during this project. I am the one at the front wearing the pink thing. I think that photo's been used in the president's newsletter. By the way, some people didn't like me in sunglasses. And this is the sort of thing you can get from it. Now, you won't be able to read it at that distance, but it's got Owen Glendower in it because he was a true patriot Englishman fighting in the English army before he rebelled. When he rebelled in 1400, he did so by declaring himself Prince of Wales on Henry of Monmouth's birthday. So, you know, these things, these symbols, were just as important then as they are now. But also on here is an archer called Gwtor Glyn. You might think, well, what's important about him? Well, he was one of the greatest Welsh poets of the 15th century. He actually wrote poems about his service in the Hundred Years' War in the 1440s, even explaining how he got himself recruited. This website, by the way, has had millions of hits. In 3 months, I think we had 3.1 million hits. But this gives you some idea of where we took the information from. This is a roll for 1387, and it shows the name of some bannerets here with the annotations of the days they arrived, that kind of thing. Here's another one, the roll for the army of 1417, with which Henry invaded France. As you can see, these are pretty inaccessible documents. And I don't mean that the TNA is useless, because it's actually very helpful in working on this stuff, but they're inaccessible in that you'd have to go there and look at them in person and then be able to read them, and they're in Latin and in French. And here we have protections. When people went abroad, they were worried about that there might be legal actions in their absence, so they took out a letter of protection, suspending legal cases, really, in their absence. And these are very useful for us as well, and this is the stuff that my team have entered onto these databases. In fact, there are three databases on the site, including one of protections. And we can also see payments for troops in the issue rolls here. You can see how much training needs to go into medieval history, but what the impression I want to give, and perhaps I need to write more on the website about this, is just how bureaucratic the English were. This is, when I've given my Agincourt court talk, it always causes a titter, probably because of the profile of the typical HA member, that this is a war fought by accountants as much as by soldiers. And this little bag here is a medieval filing system, no filing cabinets. You stuck all the documents into a little bag, made out of sheepskin, and then you hung it on a peg and you wrote the name of the soldier on it. And all these documents, this is Erpingham, all these documents are in there. So it's quite interesting things here, which I think gives us a very different portrayal of the Battle of Agincourt from the sort of popular image of it. The Welsh soldiers. Well, the other mail I get is hate mail from the Welsh, usually on scraps of blue paper written in a slightly malevolent way. Fortunately, nobody as yet has cut out letters from a newspaper. I suppose that's going to be the next stage. This is a document in the National Archives, E101 4620, 9 membranes, 3 separate musters of Welsh archers and men-at-arms in Brecon and various other places in Wales for the campaign of 1415. And one of the young men, the youngest young man on that slide, Adam Chapman, did a PhD on the Welsh soldier, because I just had got fed up with these people telling me that the Welsh won the Battle of Agincourt. So I said, go out there, Adam, and find out whether that's true or not. It isn't. There were only 500 Welsh archers raised from South Wales, as the North was still in rebellion. And he's also found that it's highly unlikely that more than 400 of them actually set out for France. The rest was sent to defend parts of Wales on an emergency basis, because there really was a feeling, a fear. Glendower was still alive at this point. They didn't know where he was. So some were left for national defence. About 60 were invalided home from the siege of Harfleur, but presumably the rest went on to the battle. But that only gets us about 400 archers out of a potential 7,000 at the battle. So, as you can imagine, for the celebrations of 2015, which are being planned, I'm on a committee with the Master of the Armouries, I do need to disabuse him of the heading for one section called the Anglo-Welsh Army at the Battle of Agincourt, because it isn't, really. So, Davy Gamm, I had an email yesterday from Australia saying, my mother was called Gaines and therefore is descended from Davy Gamm. And can you confirm that Davy Gamm was himself descended from the from Llywelyn, the last prince of Wales, from an earlier king of prince of Wales, from one of the kings of Scotland, and they named one or two other people. This is like us all being descended from Edward III, which statistically apparently is possible. Well, Davy Gamm is mentioned in some chronicles as dying at the battle, but intriguingly, he's not mentioned in any Welsh poetry of the period. In fact, the Battle of Agincourt isn't in Welsh poetry. Lots of other things are. So that also indicates it wasn't that important. It's a tradition invented then in the 16th century, and particularly in Powell's History of Cambria, now called Wales, which was published in 1584, and which encouraged Shakespeare to use the character of Llywelyn, who some people have said is Davy Gamm. There's absolutely no link at all. Davy Gamm, after all, dies in the battle, so it can't be Llywelyn, because he's still alive at the end. So there's real confusions over this, but it has got into the popular psyche. It was copied from this History of Cambria into lots and lots of other books from that point onwards. So what Adam has found is that from the reign of Edward I onwards, there was actually a decline in the use of Welsh in English armies. So with careful historical study, we can come to very different views. One thing that's always struck me is how close a historian is to a detective, and perhaps we should have CSI history. There is a bit of CSI archaeology around, of course, but perhaps we could cash in a bit more on this. This is Sir John Cressy. Round his tomb in Dodford is Lord of this Ville, Captain of Lisieux, Orbec and Pont-l'Evêque in Normandy, Counselor of King Henry in France. A colleague interested in tombs said, is that true? And I had then to go through loads and loads of sources, including the urban records of Lisieux, to try and find that out. And indeed, we can know when he was born, 25th of March 1407, because we have an Inquisition post-mortem. This isn't his, but it's one actually for one of the people, one of the rebels who fought at the Battle of Shrewsbury in 1403. But it shows you the sort of documents I'm talking about here. We can reconstruct his career, and if you look at the website, there's the whole career there. Now, the point of this is it took me quite a long time to do this because I pieced together lots of different sources in the National Archives, British Library, and lots of repositories in France. And this is another thing that popular historians tend not to do. They tend to be very uni-source based, whereas a professional historian brings in things. And this is surely what the detective does. And perhaps it's a way we could sell it to children, that it is really assembling the facts and trying to come to some sort of conclusion at the end. To emphasise the bureaucracy, this is part of, because I couldn't get it all on the photocopier, his indenture for one of his captaincies. Interesting too, this is French handwriting. If you've been very sharp, it's actually quite different in nature to the English. The French still write in a different way from us, of course. Chaucer's knight, lots of attempts to identify him. Maybe from our database we can help. Maybe Sir Richard Waldegrave, Speaker of the Commons on several occasions. Reconstructing his career from his own testimony and our database here shows all the expeditions he was in, which fit with what Chaucer says there. And also from the Court of Chivalry, we know that when he gave evidence in 1386, he said he was 48 and he'd been armed 25 years. So it's personal testimony. Can we believe that? Well, we have another one here, Edward Dallingridge, who gives testimony and serves on lots of expeditions. Very important, this one, because he's the guy who built that castle, Bodiam, the castle on which there's been more debate than any other. Is it an old soldier's folly, a dream castle. Is it fortifiable? My colleagues at Southampton are now doing a lot of archaeological work. The argument is that it's not a fortified castle, it's a dream residence. Yeah? It's sort of what was fashionable at this point in time, because a besieger could come along and drain the moat quite easily. Well, yes, but actually, would the French have sailed up the River Rother and said, oh, I know what we need to do here, guys, let's drain the moat, while they're being fired on? That's the thing. This, you've got to put it into the realms of credibility. And I think knowing more about his military career really shows us it's highly likely to have been a fortified castle. And there he is, in fact, the fourth name down there on the muster roll. But can we always believe what people tell us? And this is a problem with the court of chivalry material of this period, where we get this aged 60 and upwards, armed for 39 years, because he didn't tell us everything. We know, historians know better than people in the period, we know more now about the Middle Ages than they knew about themselves, after all. We can extend it, as you can see at the bottom, with another period of service at Roxburgh Castle. We can also look at the way soldiers were recruited, and this is quite an interesting example of recruitment for the Order of the Passion by Philippe de Mézières, trying to get peace between England and France and encouraging people to join together a saint-passage, a crusade by both the English and French to recover the Holy Land. And here he is presenting his ideas to Richard II, except it isn't him, is it? Because presumably the person who drew this, well, he might have known what Philippe de Mézières looked like, he didn't know what Richard II looked like. Yet popular works often say this is Richard II. He wrote another marketing book, interesting, this is on paper starting to be used for more informal purposes. And he even designed, in order to encourage people to join his order, rather nice flags and shields, and some snazzy outfits as well. There's even one for a woman in this, by the way. And in one of the texts, there's a list of, these are the people who've agreed to join my order. Can you imagine him going around and saying, well, the Duke of York has said he's going to come, why don't you join up? So it's marketing, really. And from this list, we can put the names in it against what we know of military service in this period. And if you saw, Cressy might have been 13 when he first started campaigning. We thought that was ludicrous, but we're finding so many starting their military career in their early teens that it now seems to be that was the standard thing for men of rank. And they might then go on, their careers would go on. You saw that one, aged 60 years. People could go on serving for very long times. And we can then look at how many of them were together on campaigns, the horizontal ties, if you like, and it's not surprising they joined up that order. They were all mates. They'd been on campaign together already. And we can play around more, as you can see, some of them, including Erpingham there, on the campaign of 1415. So there's a lot professional historians can do. I think the future has got to be the web historian. It struck me, perhaps, that if I were the president 20 years on, would I even be here? Would you be here? Would you be accessing this remotely? But perhaps we should end with saying that coming together in an association and actually meeting and talking with each other is a much more satisfactory thing, as my soldiers found going on campaign together as well. Thank you.